Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton met for their final debate. Donald Trump is making headlines for refusing to commit to accept the outcome of the election if he doesn't win. But I just got breaking news in my email, and we just heard from the BBC that now he's saying, I would like to promise and pledge to all of my voters and supporters and to all the people of the U.S. that I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election. And then he paused and said, if I win. All right, so that's making headlines today. The debate was moderated by Fox News' Chris Wallace. He opened with questions about the Supreme Court and continued to cover a number of issues, including immigration, the economy, and Social Security. For the very first time, we got a question about abortion, and we'll play a clip from that in just a couple of minutes, but Chris Wallace did not ask about climate change. In fact, we didn't get a question about climate change in any of the debates.
You just said you want to see.
Sorry about that. So today we're going to talk about the third and final debate. What really struck you about the presidential election, the presidential debate? What was the most telling moment for you? And what are you thinking about with just 3 weeks away? If you have not registered to vote yet, you have until Monday. So if anyone you know has not registered to vote, let them know that you have until Monday to register to vote here in California. Joining me to talk about the final presidential debate are two guests. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a lecturer at Columbia Law School, and the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter at the Huffington Post. Hey, Zach, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, last and final debate last night. What really struck you? Scott, what stood out for you last night?
Well, you know, the first 45 minutes of this debate, I thought it was a normal Democrat versus Republican presidential debate. Now, that was shocking. And I think it changed after that, I think. But, you know, but also, Trump was, he was just different in many ways. He was sedate. He was calm. He was squinting. His hair had been redone. It's as if someone sent him off to the stage saying, be calm, be level, don't get riled up. And he was working very hard at it. And I think that worked. I think, you know, this was his best performance by far of the three debates.
Really?
Yeah, but still, I think, far, far behind the performance of Hillary Clinton. So, you know, not a winner, but an improvement. He goes from an F to a C minus minus.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm guessing that if you listened to the debate and didn't watch it, you probably have a different perspective, because I have to say, Trump looked throughout the debate so angry the entire time, and I just thought, what is he thinking about? What is he going to do? What are your thoughts, Zach? Did you watch it or did you just listen to it?
I watched it.
What did you think?
I've watched all of the debates so far. I mean, I understand where Scott is coming from here, but I just basically disagree with him. I think this debate, more so than any other debate, was a debate where Hillary Clinton not only sort of beat Trump at the policy game, she kind of out-alphaed him. She kind of emasculated him. And if we're just talking about sort of the theater criticism here, remember throughout the Republican debates, Trump's basic technique was to belittle and bully the other people on stage by essentially trying to be the most masculine tough guy on stage, and he just did not have that last night. It seemed to me that Hillary Clinton was really to use a crude and violent metaphor, just kind of slapping him around most of the night.
Yeah.
He seemed out of his depth on the policy questions, and the moderator, Chris Wallace, I think more so than other moderators in the debate so far, was really good about asking substantive questions about policy, and then also trying to make sure that candidates actually answered them.
I thought he did a much better job than other moderators. And Scott, I have to say, just you can't help but think about gender differences happening at the debate, and I thought Hillary did an amazing job of not letting Trump get to her. I mean, he called her a nasty woman. He was pretty nasty last night, and she just kept answering. She did not let him get to her.
But conversely, she was able to get under his skin over and over and over again. I think she saw him trying to be calm and stable and decided to start throwing barbs at him from the beginning. I mean, certainly from about 10 minutes in. And I think that it did get him riled off. It threw him off his message several times. And I think, you know, her point was to show she's unflappable. She's made of steel. And he's not. He's easy to rile up and to tempt to an emotional response. And she did that, especially in the second half of the debate, I think. Mm.
All right, so beyond the emotions, let's talk about some of the issues. And I thought this was pretty telling when they were both asked about Social Security. This came up on our show yesterday about the Disability Film Festival that's taking place this weekend, Superfest. We often get a lot of callers who, you know, expressed frustration because not only is the Social Security check low, on average it's about $1,000 a month, but it's also an incredibly difficult process in terms of applying for Social Security. So here's a clip from last night's debate, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump talking about Social Security.
On record as saying that we need to put more money into the Social Security Trust Fund, that's part of my commitment to raise taxes on the wealthy. My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure that we have sufficient resources. And that will come from either raising the cap and or finding other ways to get more money into it. I will not cut benefits. I want to enhance benefits for low-income workers and for women who have been disadvantaged by the current Social Security system.
Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump talking about Social Security, that's when Donald Trump called her a nasty woman. Zach, so Hillary Clinton is saying she will not cut benefits, but when she talked about raising the cap, she said either raising the cap. So where does she stand on that?
Oh, I think that was about, I mean, back in February on Twitter, she said that she pledged not to cut Social Security benefits to anyone ever. And I think that's a sort of, you know, politicians can maybe walk back a tweet, but that seems pretty declarative to me. I will not cut benefits.
Right.
And to me, I think there were a couple of moments in this debate where, my own view is that the presidential election is effectively over. She's going to be the next president. But there were multiple instances in this debate where there were policy questions that were asked of Hillary Clinton, where she really laid down some markers that are going to be tough to walk back. I think one of them was on Social Security, and another one was when she was going after Donald Trump for the use of Chinese steel at his hotel in Las Vegas. She was making a very intense and aggressive attack at Trump from the position of sort of a free trade critic, a critic of the sort of globalization status quo. Those are not going to be statements that are easy to wash away if she wants to, and I think it suggests that she really isn't interested in washing them away. I think there has been a real shift, particularly in Washington, D.C., about where sort of the centrist establishment is on major questions of economic policy, and I think it's moved much closer to where, you know, progressive outsider economists have been over the last 15 years than where the center had been, prior.
Well, and we'll talk about this later in the show, but some of the WikiLeaks emails reveal that she can be pushed because behind the scenes, her people were talking about the Elizabeth Warren faction of the Democratic Party. And, you know, they basically say, we really need to support this because we're going to get slammed by that wing of the party. And so do you agree that the WikiLeaks emails reveal that, yes, Hillary Clinton can be pushed by the left, by the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders faction of the Democratic Party?
I mean, look, they do show Hillary Clinton is a politician who is engaged in the business of politics, who takes positions taking into account a lot of different constituencies. But I did think that this showed, you know, the WikiLeaks emails to me, to the extent that I've examined them, suggest that Hillary Clinton is someone who the left of the Democratic Party can do business with. She's also somebody who, you know, the Wall Street wing of the party can do business with, but she's not someone who is going to completely exclude them because she thinks they're, you know, a bunch of, you know, unwashed, knuckle-dragging, Neanderthals, which has sort of been the perspective of the party establishment for most of the last couple of decades, frankly. So to me, it, it suggested that she's taking their concerns seriously. I don't think, you know, I don't think Hillary Clinton's going to be the second coming of FDR, but I do think there's a lot of room for the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party to get some policy victories in here.
What do you think, Scott?
No, I think Zach's got that right, essentially. I mean, I think looking through the entire debates, one of the things I was looking for is, you know, what's the audience to which she's pitching her comments? And I thought she went into this with something of a challenge, because she really needs to nail down that Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, but she also needs to play towards a more conservative center. And I think her comments did both of those things. But I think in many of the comments, particularly the economic issues, she was more concerned about her left, about the Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren wings of the party. And I think your interpretation of the emails is spot on. Now, of course, most of these emails are not they're not Hillary Clinton speaking in most of them. They're
right.
Staffers, so we have to discount a lot of that. But I think if we look at the trajectory of her campaign and the dialogue that's going on there, one thing emerges above all other points, and that is she's very, very sensitive to the criticism that's leveled against her on the progressive left. And I think what we saw her do throughout that campaign and after, and even up to the convention and after the convention, is steadily move towards the progressive wing and embrace many of its major policy planks. And I think she's demonstrating in the debates that she's still there. And there may be more room for to move further to the left on these things. That was surprising, and that's unusual in the last weeks of an election.
Hmm. Zach, just quickly going back to Social Security, because so many of our listeners care so much about this issue and, again, rely on it for so much of their income. Can you tell us anything else about Hillary Clinton's plan on Social Security?
Well, I mean, I think they've been intentionally a little bit vague about it because they want to leave room to negotiate things. But essentially, we've heard from both Hillary Clinton in last night's debate and also from Tim Kaine in the vice presidential debate is that any plan to deal with entitlements or the debt, which was, you know, an entire category of questions last night, they're going to focus on raising the cap on taxable income that's relevant to the payroll taxes that fund Social Security. That's where they're focused. And she said explicitly, "I'm not going to cut benefits." I mean, she's talked about trying to make the program pay better for workers who. You know, who maybe are whose labor does not get included in the system quite as much as others, particularly women workers, home care workers, people who do not have as high lifetime wages because they do work inside the house that is uncompensated and thus does not end up being taxed by a payroll tax. So she's talking about a significant increase in benefits for effectively lower wage workers there.
Today we are talking about the final debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We're joined by Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post, Scott Horton, contributing editor with Harper's Magazine and a lecturer at Columbia Law School. Scott is author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. If that title grabs you, we had Scott on to talk about that. You can search for it at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you today. If you watched the debate, what did you think? What stood out for you? And we are just under 3 weeks until the election day. So what are you thinking about right now? The last 6 months, 8 months have been kind of surreal in many ways. So what really stood out for you? It's almost here. What are you thinking? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And again, you have until Monday to register to vote. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Rob in San Francisco. 3 weeks until the election, and my thoughts are it can't be over soon enough. I think Hillary Clinton has been the adult on stage throwing out lines, knowing the rise she would get out of Donald Trump. We have another email from Harriet in San Francisco regarding the debate. Someone said performance, which is exactly what they are. Given the importance of the election, we are really going to vote on how the candidates performed at a given moment. These are not roles in a play. Even if the vile and pathetic Mr. Trump enacts the part of a sane, deliberate person, is that a reason to take his candidacy seriously? Boy, are we going to miss the genuine and serious Obamas. Well, Harriet, in the cable world, that's pretty much all that matters, his performance, but we wanted to talk a little bit about that and then move on to issues. Thank you for writing. Sarah says, it's time for more grown-up realism about the nature of political speech these days. Hillary Clinton had to navigate a fractious field full of landmines from left and right-wing idealists. She's more focused on retaining credibility than being inspiring, perhaps learning from Obama's terrible 8 years of racist ideological obstruction. Clinton is a pragmatist with private thoughts, public postures, and an eye to compromise. And we have Tim, who says, I was amazed at Chris Wallace. It seemed like there was an adult journalist in the room asking questions with follow-ups. What a concept. It's been hard to watch as a flawed candidate, Hillary, has to stand up to a just-make-stuff-up entertainer. Now we're confronted with Trump supporters who say we're preparing for civil war, too many guns, and not enough education. Well, thank you for that. You know, that's the other thing is, on the Supreme Court, Scott, I mean, this is one of your areas of expertise. Trump just didn't sound like he knew what he was talking about. I mean, he mentioned the Second Amendment twice, but he just sort of said something like, the Supreme Court, that's where it's at.
No, in fact, I think he's got it down to just a couple of hot-button issues, of which the Second Amendment is the big one. I sort of wondered at one point if Chris Wallace had asked him to discuss the qualifications of one of the people he listed as a potential nominee, if he would even be able to recall the names of any of the people he put forward. I think he really was not able to field that in any sort of convincing way, whereas, you know, Hillary Clinton, what can we say? She's a lawyer. She speaks like a lawyer. That's the plus and the minus. I mean, you have a very clear sense. She has complete mastery of this. She understands it. She understands it in the policy depth. And she sort of drones on about it a little bit too much in a way that it doesn't sell itself very effectively to a large audience.
Well, let's play a clip about the Supreme Court and abortion. This was the very first time that abortion came up in the debates. If you listen to the show a lot, you know that we've done a lot of shows about abortion and how so many laws have been passed across the country at the state level to chip away at abortion rights. Now, what was missing from Mike Wallace's question that I think is very important, because he brought up late abortions. This is a very important stat. The federal government estimates that about 92% of abortions are performed in the first 13 weeks of pregnancy. An estimated 1.3% of abortions happen later than 21 weeks into pregnancy. And I wish Mike Wallace would have said that. He didn't, but here's the clip.
I want to see the court overturn. You just said you want to see the court protect the Second Amendment. Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v.
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be, that's will happen. And that'll happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court. I will say this, it will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination.
Donald has said he's in favor of defunding Planned Parenthood. He even supported shutting the government down to defund Planned Parenthood. I will defend Planned Parenthood. I will defend Roe v. Wade, and I will defend women's rights to make their own health care decisions.
Secretary,
and we have come too far to have that turn back now. And indeed, he said women should be punished, that there should be some form of punishment for women who obtain abortions. And I could just not be more opposed to that kind of thinking.
If you go with what Hillary is saying, in the ninth month, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb of the mother just prior to the birth of the baby. Now, you can say that that's okay, and Hillary can say that that's okay, but it's not okay with me. Because based on what she's saying and based on where she's going and where she's been, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the ninth month on the final day. And that's not acceptable.
Well, that is not what happens in these cases. And using that kind of scare rhetoric is just terribly unfortunate. You should meet with some of the women that I've met with, women I've known over the course of my life. This is one of the worst possible choices that any woman and her family has to make. And I do not believe the government should be making it. And I can tell you the government has no business in the decisions that women make with their families, in accordance with their faith, with medical advice. And I will stand up for that right.
I mean, nobody has business doing what I just said, doing that as late as 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 days prior to birth. Nobody has that.
All right. Do you want to?
And that's a clip from last night's debate. Doctors went on Twitter to say there is no such thing as a 9-month abortion. And again, for the record, an estimated 1.3% of abortions happen later than 21 weeks into pregnancy. That was not mentioned. But Hillary Clinton did try to let people know that this is very rare. And when this does happen, it's obviously incredibly traumatic. Zach, this is the first time that abortion was raised during the debates. And I mean, this was really a disgusting answer from Donald Trump.
That was really, I think, the worst answer I may have ever heard
yep.
to a debate question ever. To be blunt, you know, I think one thing that's interesting about the Republican Party more broadly is that this man is still their nominee, despite not being able to really speak the language of the Christian right. And for a long time, the Republican coalition has been built. People like Paul Ryan, who are enthusiastic about tax cuts for the wealthy, who want to see a lot of corporate deregulation, have tried to figure out a way to form a winning coalition. It's hard to do that because, you know, you're basically talking about the 1%, and you need 51% to win elections. So one way they've tried to do that is by wooing the Christian right. And Donald Trump is just terrible at talking to the Christian right. I remember early in the primary season, he gave a comment where he said that women who have abortions should be punished for that. That's not actually out of step with a lot of the views of people on the Christian right, but it's a big no-no on Christian right messaging because it's very unpopular to talk about people being punished for going through something that's obviously not an easy decision for most people to make, or at least frequently not an easy decision for people to make. It's an unpopular thing to do. He just does not understand the Christian right at all, and yet despite that, he's been able to put together enough of a coalition to essentially take over the Republican Party. And I think it suggests that, you know, whatever type of coalition the Republicans try to put together going forward, it's not going to look the way it has looked for the past 30 years.
Hmm. Scott, what about you? I mean, what strikes me is now major Republicans running for high office have no problem going on record saying that they oppose abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. This was definitely not the case when John McCain was running for president.
I think, you know, the issue generally is fading for them because it just doesn't command the sort of fervor or the raw numbers that it once had. And I think this is another example of, I think it's both Trump's failure to grasp proper language and messaging, and it's just off the chart cynicism. I mean, you can look at this issue of Planned Parenthood and reproductive rights generally, and name me a position that Donald Trump has not embraced in the past. He's been all over everything, including embracing for long periods of time really fairly aggressive reproductive rights views, and giving money to Planned Parenthood. I see cynicism in this, and I thought his language was just shocking.
Mm. Very shocking. Today we're speaking about last night's debate, and again, for the first time, the moderator, Fox News' Chris Wallace, asked about abortion, and we just played the clip there. About where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton stand on these issues. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and a lecturer at Columbia Law School. Zach Carter is senior political economy reporter at the Huffington Post. Last night, the candidates talked about Social Security, the Supreme Court, immigration, the economy. What really stood out for you last night? And with just under 3 weeks away, what are you thinking about right now? And again, Monday is the last day to register to vote here in California. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question or idea or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up at 11 o'clock on the special election edition of Your Call, San Francisco Supervisor Jane Kim will join us to talk about her race for the California Senate to replace Mark Leno, who is being termed out. If you have any questions for Jane Kim, I hope you can join us at 11 o'clock. And then on election night, we are going to be doing a special live broadcast at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. Doors at 6:30 will be live from 7 to 9 o'clock p.m. The Roxy is in San Francisco, 3117 16th Street. So if you're looking to be around friends and community on election night, I hope you can join us for that special broadcast. And today we are talking about last night's debate. It was the last debate. What stood out for you? What was the most telling moment for you? And then with just 3 weeks away, what are you thinking right now? I feel like actually after Election Day, we're going to have a big therapy session to all get together and talk about what this election has done to all of us. And if you want to talk about that today, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Zach Carter is senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and a lecturer at Columbia Law School. He's also author of the book Lords of Secrecy. And we've got full lines, so let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Two things. I felt that the questions that were asked were just rehash of other debates. There were no new questions, really. There was nothing on the environment, nothing on global warming, nothing on, Black Lives Matter, or on, poverty, anything like that. I was very disappointed in that. And the other thing is I didn't feel, in most cases, that neither candidate answered the questions, maybe on abortion. But when Hillary Clinton was asked about the Clinton Foundation, a kind of a, pay-as-you-go, she just kept talking about how wonderful the Clinton Foundation was, and she didn't answer any of the question, the questions about that. And of course, Trump was Trump. But I just feel really sorry that the country is going through this. And Hillary has never, on any of the debates, really spoke about the dissatisfaction of people in this country, why they are supporting Trump erroneously. But it was just, it was kind of like a three-ring circus. I mean, she obviously held her own, but she certainly wasn't very clear on her answers. Mm. And
well, thank you for calling, Nancy. Have either of you looked into this? So Mike Wallace asked about a conflict of interest with the Clinton Foundation, saying that emails show that donors got special access to Hillary Clinton. He also said those seeking grants for Haiti relief were considered separately from non-donors, and some of those donors got contracts, government contracts, and taxpayer money. Hillary Clinton said, "I did as Secretary of State. What I did as Secretary of State was in furtherance of our country's interests and our values. The State Department has said that. I think that's been proven." She says, "I'm thrilled to talk about the foundation. It's a world-renowned charity." Zach or Scott, have you looked into this? And what are your thoughts?
I've looked into it somewhat.
Scott.
I think that, and I've been pretty critical of a lot of the coverage of the foundation, because a lot of it is written by journalists who don't really understand very much how foundations operate or how they keep their books. But I would say it's a fair area for asking questions. And what has come up is a lot of evidence that people got access to her and other people in the State Department higher up as a result, most likely, of having made donations to the Clinton Foundation. Now, of course, you've got to keep in mind, that's a charity. They're making donations to a charity. The money's being spent for charitable purposes. And it's access to her, so they had meetings, but there's nothing showing that there was an attempt to influence the granting of contracts on a for-profit basis that was incorrect. So they haven't really made out a clear-cut case of corruption in any of the large number of cases that have surfaced and been discussed. But I won't rule out the possibility that they may be able to do that at some point.
What about the question around the contributions from Saudi Arabia? Donald Trump always says that the Clinton Foundation received $25 million from Saudi Arabia. PolitiFact looked it up and says, according to the foundation's website, Saudi Arabia has given between $10 and $25 million since the foundation started. The Washington Post reported Saudi Arabia gave about $10 million to build the Clinton Presidential Library. So what about the question to Hillary Clinton? Will you give that money back?
You want me to jump in here?
Sure, Zach.
I don't know if it makes sense for her to give that money back, but I mean, look, it may be the case that Saudi Arabia and Qatar's governments are giving money to the foundation because they really believe in their purest of true benevolent hearts that this is the most efficient way to, you know, solve global poverty and fix the AIDS crisis in the developing world. I think that the trick with the Clinton Foundation, though, is that it creates the appearance of a conflict. It's not just another foundation. It's not just another charity. It's run by someone who's currently running for president, who was a Secretary of State, and it's sort of a way of gathering international political prestige. And so it may be the case that they've never been caught with a smoking gun where they exchanged a bag of cash for a specific position on some issue. But there's a long history of sort of thought about corruption and anti-corruption policy in the United States, which was eventually sort of put in the ground by the Citizens United decision in 2010, which said that when there are structures in place that create a public distrust of institutions by establishing the appearance of a conflict of interest or the appearance of corruption, then this is a problem. And I think we can say, I feel very comfortable saying that the Clinton Foundation is a problematic institution in that respect, even though what Hillary Clinton said about the work that they do is all correct. They don't waste their donors' money on pointless overhead. They do invest in things that actually do make the world a better place. But I think there's a real problem with the way with the perceptions it creates.
She said that the foundation spends 90% on money on behalf of programs of people around the world, not so 10% goes to overhead. Just to get those facts out there. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Nancy. Let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'd like to change my question a little bit. One of the other callers raised a question that I thought was significant about the lack of questions at any of the debates about global warming, climate change, etc. And I'd like the guest's perspective on whether that could be because when you look at Fox and CNN, who have been involved with the debates, they're replete with advertisements by the fossil fuel industry. I'm a energy voter, et cetera, et cetera. Could that be influencing the fact that the people from those networks, when they ask questions on the debates, do not discuss issues that might detrimentally affect the fossil fuel industry?
Well, thank you for that question. Scott Horton, what do you think?
Bingo. That's what I think.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I've talked to people on the staff at CBS News, major networks as well, and asked them, do you get pressure from your editors or from corporate not to cover these issues? And the answer is, yes, we get pressure not to cover these issues. And where does that pressure come from? Ultimately, it comes from the fossil fuel industry itself, which is a major source of advertising revenue for these companies. It may have all sorts of other, I mean, we're now dealing with, corporate giants in news world. There may be all sorts of other connections. I've never gone in and tried to chart it, but I think that's a clear point. And to me, the most important issue that was unaddressed in these, I think except for one sort of out-of-the-blue statement by Hillary, really wasn't addressed in the question in any of the debates, were the environmental questions. And I think science issues generally were just ignored. It seems to me that the questioning over three debates was shocking and failing to cover that. And, voters under 25 in a survey that was conducted for The Guardian named this as their number one issue in the election.
And, obviously Fox News is known for bringing on so many climate deniers.
Precisely. I mean, you know, so if anything, you have a record on Fox of denialism and skepticism about science generally.
Zach, anything to add there?
I just remember when Marco Rubio was running for president, and I think a lot of the Republican establishment has been sort of saying, well, look, we just sort of had a fluke that this one very bad man ran for president for us. We had all these other guys who were pretty good. You know, remember when Marco Rubio was asked about, you know, some pretty basic climate science stuff, he just said, I'm not a scientist, man. This has been part of the Republican Party's sort of theology, really, for the last 25 years or so. And so I think to some extent, even for TV audiences, aside from the, you know, sort of pay-to-play issues that Scott was talking about, it becomes less interesting for people, because if you know anything about politics, you know Republicans are just going to be deniers about it. I think that's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, and actually Marco Rubio was in a debate with Patrick Murphy in Florida this week. Patrick Murphy, the Democrat, Marco Rubio, the Republican. And Think Progress headline is, as climate change floods Florida, Marco Rubio refuses to even acknowledge the science. He was asked about sea level rising, and he said, if in fact sea levels are rising, if in fact, as if you just have to walk out your front door in Florida and see that it is in fact rising. So we're gonna do a show about these Senate races. Marco Rubio is in a race in Florida, and let's go to our next caller. Thank you for that, William. Let's hear from Rich in San Francisco. Hi, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Rose. Love the show as always. I'll try to be brief with my question. Quick observation and then a question. One of the biggest concerns I have is watching Trump's campaign now go spouting about the country at all these big rallies that he's having, that voter fraud is happening everywhere, when there's no evidence for that. And people have investigated this. Ari Berman, I believe, has a book on it. But he's promoting this. He's now calling, saying, well, I'll let you know once the election results come in if I accept them. I would love if the guests could comment on, and Rose, I'd welcome you to comment on this too, because you covered this issue a lot. What danger this poses to democracy in a country where we have 330 million guns, and we have one political party in particular who won't let any legislation on guns pass. We saw 20 or so first grade children killed, and teachers and school administrators, and our Congress passed no legislation. Nothing happened. And so what danger does this really pose? Because it strikes me as very, very dangerous, what he's doing.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. And on PBS just a couple days ago, they were talking about this, and one of the guests says he's concerned that because Trump is asking his supporters to go to polling places to watch what's happening, he's afraid people are going to show up with guns. Scott, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, just on that last point, I mean, he has been encouraging people to, after they vote, go to a polling place, and he always says, in the inner cities, it's always Philadelphia, it's Chicago, he cites that they should go to. And the first thing we should note is that the Republican Party had an organized practice of doing that in the 1980s and earlier, and they were sued over it. And they had to enter into a consent decree in which they represented they would not do this. So, of course, what he's encouraging people to do is a violation of the consent decree and illegal under American law. But, you know, let's stop and look at what's underneath this. So the election's rigged and it's unfair. And how is it unfair? And I guess we have a bunch of different justifications thrown out by him. But usually it's that there's fraud that's going on in the inner cities, and certain inner cities in particular, Philadelphia and Chicago. So we can stop at one point and say, does anyone at this point think that either Illinois or Pennsylvania are going to be carried by Trump? No, no one thinks that. Mm. So it's really irrelevant in the first point. Second point is it's really racist. I mean, so he's saying it's minorities, it's blacks in particular, who are to be connected with all of this voting fraud. And I think a lot of what he's saying boils down to, yeah, the idea of anyone other than white people voting is bad. I don't want that to happen. It's illegitimate. And he tosses out different names. So I think over the last 2 days he's also been saying foreigners go out and vote. You know, we've had scientific studies run looking into all of these sorts of accusations. In Philadelphia, one was run. Another was done in North Carolina because the Republicans made these claims after 2008 as well. And all these studies say, nope, didn't happen. I mean, there's almost no anecdotal evidence, and the statistical evidence is pretty clear-cut that it's not happening.
Right. The Washington Post, this is one of my favorite pieces on this, in 2014, this headline says it all. A comprehensive investigation of voter impersonation finds 31 credible incidents out of 1 billion ballots cast. So 31 out of 1 billion. And if he wants to talk about African Americans, Zach, it seems like because Donald Trump is talking about voter fraud, this is a very good opportunity for the media to say, well, let's talk about voter suppression. Because Kristen Clark was on Democracy Now! This morning. She's the ED of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. And she said, you know, let's talk about this. We've got a lawsuit today in Hancock County, Georgia, where they have purged and removed legitimately registered African Americans from the registration rolls. And they have the sheriff's office go to your home, issue a summons telling you you've got to come down to the registrar's office to provide proof of your eligibility. In Macon-Bibb County in Georgia, they've moved a polling site out of a majority black school to the local sheriff's office, which is the location deemed hostile by African-American voters there. So, you know, Donald Trump wants to say that fraud exists when it doesn't. This is a good time for the media to talk about voter suppression with just 3 weeks left until Election Day.
There's something really tempting with the Trump phenomenon to because he uses so much of the sort of stylistic bombast of like a traditional strongman in a dictatorship, to think of him as something that's totally removed from the Republican Party's recent history. But I mean, the fact is this discussion about alleged voter fraud does go hand in hand with a history of voter suppression, and they're both sort of just they're both racist policies that the Republican Party has been implementing on the ground for a long time. You know, there used to be an organization called the Association of Community Organizers for Reform Now, and it was an anti-poverty group whose sort of most high-profile staffers tended to be black. And the Republican Party just tried to destroy that organization, and ultimately did, by alleging voter fraud for years. And one of the tactics they would accuse Acorn people of doing was registering people who were not eligible to vote. And this is different from actual voter fraud. It's, you know, problems with voter registration. They would register somebody like Mickey Mouse to try to get credit for some sort of internal metric for a number of voters registered. Voter registration problems, which are what Republicans point to all the time when they say that voter fraud is rampant, are extremely difficult to turn into actual voter fraud. If you write down Mickey Mouse on a piece of paper and register Mickey Mouse to vote, Mickey Mouse can't vote until, you know, a 4 foot tall talking mouse shows up at the polling place. Donald Trump Jr. last night was talking about, you know, 4 million dead people being on the voter rolls in America. Well, you dead people end up on the voter rolls when they die. There are 318 million people in the United States. The fact that some of them have died since the last time they registered is not really that big a problem. But clearly, these are ideas and emotions that the Republican Party has been dependent on for years and has really actively stoked.
And I saw a few analysts, one in particular Trump supporter on CNN, who was repeating that number over and over last night. What do you think this is doing for, you know, Trump supporters who are believing this information and are right today saying this election, the outcome will not be fair?